Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Monday, June 29th. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by Pete Sampson of The Athletic and John Bryce of USA Today, recently of Carnival Cruise Lines. I believe, JB, you are part of the problem that is causing these fights on the cruises. No, actually, JB and his lovely wife, Jess, went on an Alaskan cruise, and he's home from that. Guys, we have not convened together, the three of us, for a while. And we should probably talk a little bit about recruiting, because even after our last podcast Thursday, Albert Simeon's commitment made, I believe, 10, Pete Sampson, in May and June, and at least six of great consequence.
Yeah, it's, I think that they have four top 100 linemen committed, or I'm sorry, four top 50 overall prospects who are just linemen. So it's a pretty impressive haul. I think Simeon is, there's not a lot of body types like that. They have an easier time finding Will Black types than Albert Simeon types, just from like the, he's more of the Quentin Nelson square brawler type of interior lineman, a guard who is a guard. So yeah, it's a, I mean, they're doing a great job. They typically have done a great job in June. So I'm not sure that, you know, recruiting feels a whole lot different than it did last year, but like, that's a compliment of the recruiting operation.
Yeah, I think it's been the last 2 years that we've seen Notre Dame, particularly in June, really hit a new level under Marcus Freeman. I tried to talk to some people over the weekend about kind of what they attributed it to. Obviously, Notre Dame is very competitive in the marketplace. And then, as it was put to me, once we get them on campus after that, Coach Free does a lot of the heavy lifting and takes care of the rest. Of course, Pete Bavakwa is very active in helping Notre Dame recruit. He's always willing to meet with any and most every recruit that Notre Dame is on the verge of taking or accepting a commitment from. And yeah, Notre Dame's line class, when you put the two sides of the trenches together, is about as good or better than anybody out there. And then I think that even though per 247, Miami has more four stars committed than Notre Dame or Texas A&M, it sure looks like it's Texas A&M and Notre Dame battling till the end for the top recruiting class.
Pete Sampson, I think the best running back you covered in your 25 years of covering Notre Dame football for a very long time was Julius Jones. Now his son, Julius Jones, will be attending Notre Dame, four-star wide receiver, and also a little bit of a surprise, his brother jumped in, Andre Jones, as well for 2028. Your view of Jones, senior or junior? You choose, for anybody that's listening.
I think we're I did love Julius Jones senior.
I figured, yes, we all did. For
the, pretty good player.
Lost cause, right? Lost cause season for Julius Jones, though, in 03.
Yeah, it's hard to think back. It's like, oh, there was a time where like you could lose an entire season due to academics. You know, things have changed a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it's funny you think Julius Jones' record-breaking performance came in a game against Larry Fitzgerald, and now their sons will be in the same position room at Notre Dame. So kind of a fun full circle moment there. But yeah, I mean, look, Julius Jones Jr. was about as must-get-y of a must-get prospect in this class. It was, there are very few prospects like Bryce Young was another one where you're just, what are we even doing here if you don't get these guys? Julius Jones Jr. was a, what are we even doing here if you don't get them? And they got them.
And funny note on Julius Jones, or coincidental note on Julius Jones Sr., he's from Southwest Virginia. Our hometowns were separated by a mere 40 miles or so.
Big Stone Gap, right? He's Big Stone.
I mean, it's barely across the state line in Virginia there, tucked into the southwest corner. But that was also a huge recruiting loss at the time for Philip Fulmer in Tennessee.
He was... We're going down a rabbit hole here, but Julius, if you haven't watched Julius Jones, the running back, Google him. Don't just watch the Pittsburgh highlights, because Pete, I mean, that's about as breakout as you get for a fifth-year running back. I know he was good prior. He had the Nebraska kick return. He was a good player, but when you miss your senior year for academics, return, and I mean, they would have been 2-10 without him that year.
Yeah, he had a funky career, I thought. I think for the first 4 years, he was kind of more like hyped up than he... Like he killed Navy, and that was kind of it. I mean, I think it was like half of his 100-yard games all came against Navy until the very end when he was awesome. But yeah, he was, you know, we talk about this, like the Jonas Gray thing all the time. Like, you know, the guy who doesn't break out until the end. I think Julius Jones was better than that his first 4 years. But, you know, that last year, man, he really put it all together.
He was also better than that his last year, as much as I like Jonas Gray. That's how good.
Yeah. Yes. On all fronts. Yeah.
On the topic of recruiting still, both is the word we like to use here. Braden Parks at Notre Dame and Oregon playing the waiting game. They have finally hit the point where both would be a luxury, Pete Sampson. That's what you always want, right? When you're going for defensive tackles, interior linemen, that was the last frontier. JB has been saying it long enough where he has to change from saying Notre Dame needs SEC defensive tackles to Big Ten defensive tackles because they win all the championships now, JB.
Yeah, no, exactly. And pretty soon we may be saying the SEC needs Notre Dame defensive tackles.
Defensive tackles, yes. But Parks, Tim Priester has done film reviews on Parks. He mentioned Notre Dame is a better fit for Parks than Oregon. It's going to come down to, well, it comes down to keeping him these days too. But we'll get to that and keeping these recruits in the NIL era. Guys, I don't know if you got a chance. I spoke with Micah Shrewsbury with a handful, small handful of reporters last Thursday. And interesting thing he said, I think the takeaway for me is in his first 3 years, he had six seniors. I'm sorry, in his first 3 years, he had 10 seniors, and this year he has six. So the team can look a little different, but the difference here is you got old, you didn't stay old because those guys haven't played yet together. So it's not actually the cohesive senior group Mike Bray used to put together, and obviously less talented too, but they're relying on senior experience, maybe guys that want to be here a little bit more, but it's less talent than Notre Dame had going into last year's roster.
I am highly skeptical, as probably everyone else is, because you went from year one to year two, where we're going to focus on defense now, year two to year three. Now I have all of my guys that I recruited, and now year four, it's like, actually, I want seniors instead. So I get it. What he was trying wasn't working. I'm not sure this will work either, but they didn't really have a choice after Cole Sertan, Jalen Harrelson, and Marcus Burton walked out the door.
Yeah, and I would just say, I was at Excel Sports Symposium in Atlanta on this past Thursday and Friday, so literally landed in Vancouver and got home from Vancouver about midnight, Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, and then Thursday morning at 3 a.m. headed to the airport to fly cross country for that symposium. I only bring that up because there was a coaches roundtable, and it was talking about senior players, and they said, well, okay, you have X number of seniors on your team. How many years have they been in your program? And these coaches were almost unanimous in saying, we would rather have even a second or third year player in our program, even if he's just in his second or third year of college, versus a senior, because they already know expectations. So to your point, O'Malley, I think it's a good one. Yeah, they're old, but they're not old and cohesive. They're not old and have been together for a really long time playing with one another and knowing each other's tendencies. And I think there's merit to that, arguably more so on the basketball court than the football field.
We're still in segment one, but we're going to entertain two questions because there were a lot of good questions on IrishIllustrated.com today. The first one, and this is on everybody's minds, reached out to you guys. Perfect timing. Jim Booney, CRS, longtime contributor. While recruiting is hot right now and fun to talk about, are there any interesting tidbits you could share from summer workouts on guys actually on the roster?
Go ahead, Pete.
You're up. No, I'm passing this one to you.
Yeah, I talked to some people in the program over the course of the weekend after O'Malley alerted me to this, and they were just sort of like, look, not a cop-out answer. The guys you would expect to lead are leading, the Drake Bowens, the people like that. But they did specifically mention Mylon Graham. And then in terms of newcomers, Ian Primmer, the quote was, he is the next great one. Wait and see. Ian Primmer is turning everyone's heads in summer workouts. So that's kind of my most noteworthy nuggets there. O'Malley, I don't know how much you guys have discussed Charles Jagasaw and that continues to obviously to have shifted from a very optimistic outlook to a very pessimistic outlook. But in terms of what's going on right now, then there is, again, the leadership is really carrying the load. But in terms of players there now that were not there a year ago, Mylon Graham and Ian Primmer specifically were two that were mentioned to me.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about Mylon Graham. Continue to, obviously, CJ Carr is running the shop right now as they get into player-led practices for the month of July. But, you know, it's similar to, I mean, we're at the end of spring practice. Like, what are the most interesting position battles? It's like wide receiver six and like cornerback number five. Like, yeah, I mean, I've heard a few good things about DJ McKinney. I mean, yeah. Everyone has. If you're on social media and saw what he looks like in the weight room, it was like, oh, yeah, it's a fifth year senior. But I don't think there's a whole lot of revelations out there for summer with this team. The guys who, like JB said, I agree and have heard the same. It's like the guys you think would look good have looked good, you know, and that includes Ian Primmer. A five-star tight end looks good. Okay. Yeah, that's how it's supposed to work.
The most, I've said this before, but the most important thing for Ian Premmer is that when I asked people in the spring about the passing game, Ian Premmer wasn't on campus and they mentioned Ian Premmer. It is just something that does not happen. And people, by people, I mean coaches. I don't mean just dudes. So like, no one talks about, no coaches talk about guys not on campus. That's not a thing that happens. So they knew what they were getting in Premmer. We're doing our countdown now, and Premmer's already come up. And I am proud to say I ranked Ian Premmer in the top 35, even though he did not appear in the top 35 in our countdowns. I just think Ian Premmer will carve a niche as the season goes on. You could have a couple tight ends score more touchdowns than Eli Raritan did last year, as good as Eli Raritan could end up being in the pros, which is just the strangest thing. On McKinney, I did a study on McKinney and Gray in the offseason, and it was kind of trying to use it for the countdown, but I think it's just time to maybe put it up there as a little I'm not really trying to compare him because Gray has mostly moved to nickel. As far as we know, Christian Gray is slated to be the lead nickel with Dallas Gold involved too. But McKinney and Gray had almost identical numbers from Pro Football Focus in terms of catches, targets, missed tackles, run stuffs, stops, which they call a failure for the offense, all the way through anything you want to grade a corner, except Christian Gray had way more penalties. And that's an interesting dynamic. What you could be getting is a cleaner, maybe stronger Christian Gray and DJ McKinney. I mean, they were almost down the line in terms of yards allowed, touchdowns allowed. It was just Christian Gray, maybe because he was beat up. We talked about this with Priester. He clutches and holds a lot. And I think that is something that probably was not to his benefit when you're opposite Leonard Moore, because if they're looking at you every single play and you're clutching and holding a lot, they're going to see you getting clutching and holding a lot when you're being targeted. JB, saw your story on Will Stein, big game hunting in Kentucky, but there's a related question. You spoke to Kenny Minchie, and we talked offline about this. Kenny Minchie, of course, you noted in the story, felt he won the job last year for Notre Dame, which, as most competitors would, and we know it was close, would feel he won the job. This question from Nick DeBose has a theory for 2027, and it's too early for you to answer this one, but it's going to lead into your conversation with Kenny Minchie. CJ Carr will have a glorious season and turns pro after the year. Kenny Minchie has a very good year at Kentucky, maybe not great, which given UK's schedule this upcoming season would still be very impressive. Any chance ND takes a swing at Minchie to come back in 2027? Well, because this question gets asked almost every podcast list, but I just wanted to lead into your conversation with Kenny Minchie because I love his attitude.
Yeah, and I will have a full feature on Kenny coming probably in July. I don't know. I have more layers of people that help try to make my writing look coherent at USA Today, so that's a big plus. But it also means I don't do an interview and turn a story around for the next day most of the time. But Kenny Minchie was a fantastic visit, and I point blank asked him. I said, Kenny, were there times last August? And I reminded him, you know, even though I was there on behalf of USA Today, that live part of the year in South Bend, et cetera, and that we had talked before and he knew all that. And I said, so were there times last August where you walked off the practice field and felt you had won the starting job? And he said, absolutely. And I felt it in spring too. And said he felt it a lot in spring. Most of the time exiting the practice field in spring, he felt that he'd put in the work and had the body of work to be Notre Dame's starting quarterback. So interesting stuff there. He carries that with him, obviously, to Kentucky. Kentucky has one of the most brutal schedules anywhere in all of college football, but Kenny was raving about working with Will Stein and Joe Sloan and the level of coaching he's getting. And I think I even used that particular quote in my Will Stein story. And obviously, Will Stein has helped with Dillon Gabriel, Bo Nix, and Dante Moore just in recent years. So he's got pretty strong quarterback work there coming from his head coach. Like a linebacker, you want to go play for Marcus Freeman. I understand a quarterback wanting to go play for Will Stein.
Pete Stamps, I think you said it about Kenny Minchie. Last spring, he went from, well, he's obviously the guy that's going to transfer going into the spring to, well, it looks like he just caught up and he is going to force another transfer. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, that I think coming out of spring last year, I didn't get the sense talking to anybody that he had positioned himself to win the job. But I do think the August competition, for how much I think a few steps removed, we were like, this is like kind of like a farce. Like it's you're setting this up for Carr to win the job, right? But talking to enough people, I think we all have now, it's just like, no, Minchie was right there. Like it was, I think Minchie earned the right to believe he had won the job, which I think probably would get to, would I go back to a place that didn't name me the starter when I felt I should have been the starter. And I think the answer is probably not.
I thought the comeback answer is a no too.
Yeah. But hey, Steve Angeli might be available. So you got
That's true. If you've ever thought I should really start a sportscast about my team, Zen AI makes it easy to actually do it. Zen AI is the home of vibecasting. You have a real conversation and it turns into something worth sharing. Whether that's a sportscast, clips, or TikToks, no production skills are required. Your phone is the audio, so you can record from the couch, the bar, or walking out of the stadium and still get solid audio without fancy gear. At the heart of Zen AI is an AI-assisted producer that cleans up your audio, finds the best moments, and creates share-ready clips you can tweak just by chatting in plain English. Vibecast live as the game unfolds, or jump on right after for instant reactions and analysis. Bring your own co-host or find another fan in Zen AI's network. Hit record, and you have a draft of your sportscast ready by the final buzzer. Humans are the talent. AI is the infrastructure. Vibes required. Production is optional. Zen AI is invite only right now, and they're actually paying new Vibecasters to create their first Vibecast. So try it as a one-off, short, raw experiment. Go to zen.ai to join the waitlist, or hit the link in our show notes for a shot at early access. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question is from GCAF. If this season were to turn into 2015 and the starting quarterback goes down and the backup has to play the rest of the year, do you think this team will still make the playoffs? And I want to remind people, in 2015, I had to look this up because it was so bad. That means Notre Dame has to lose not only its starting quarterback in game two, but its starting running back, its starting nose tackle, a starting safety, its starting nickel, its starting tight end, the backup running back for a few games, its best cornerback at the end of the year for a few games, its dime defender, who was Drew Tranquil at the time, maybe call that Luke Talich, and of course, CJ Carr.
Well, if we're just talking quarterback, then yeah, absolutely. I honestly think that they would go 10-2 with any of the four quarterbacks on the roster.
You'd rather not lose those 12 guys I just mentioned, though, too, right?
But you could not. I mean, we should talk about and correctly laud some of the depth that Notre Dame has built, but like that's a different level of depth. Although the 2015 team, to be fair, did they beat anybody good?
No. Well, I mean, Temple was fine.
That's it. I mean, you don't need to say anything else when you say Temple is fine. Is your
USC
first
was fine? USC was fine. That was
That
was the Adoree Jackson team. That was a fun game. Yeah, they were fine. But that's the normal 9-win USC team is what they beat. But yeah, they lost to great Clemson, very quality Stanford, but they should have beaten them. And of course, by the time they played Ohio State, they had no shot.
They were decimated.
Clemson was that garbage rub play, right? Like Notre Dame won that. I forget where I was at in the SEC, but we were watching the end of that game after leaving a press box.
No, that was the monsoon game.
Yeah, that was the monsoon. And
Clemson jumped out to a huge lead.
Yeah, okay.
All right. They were clearly better than Notre Dame. Yeah. Like Notre Dame had a really nice comeback, but it just kind of felt they were played desperate for it and then went for two for no reason.
Yes, that was the loose emoji moment where he said, I always go back to Lou and I agree on everything. Never go for two that early. It just doesn't work out. And then Elmer got bundled when they had to go for two for the time at the end. So that'd be tough, JB. That'd be tough losing all those guys. But yeah, I agree with Pete. Regular injuries, any quarterback can get them to 10-2.
Okay, well then let me ask you this. With the changes to the selection process and the manipulation that we saw in order to have Miami be the ACC representative, 10-2 Notre Dame without CJ Carr, can they get in?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of hedging by saying 10-2 because I'm not sure they'd make it at 10-2. Unless they had BYU or Miami as one of the 10.
Yeah, there you go. I think if they had one of those, I'm at 10-2 because
– especially like you lose the game CJ Carr went down. Like
right, and it's Wisconsin or something.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I'd say they just don't lose those guys, and it's more fun to watch the football.
Or those games.
Or those games. It's true. It's a way to go. Beat Temple, too, every time you can. Next question. Irish from A2. Which non-Notre Dame players nationally are you higher on than most for 2026? Who are you lower on than most?
I think Arch Manning is going to be incredible. So I know people are high on him. I am incredibly high on him. So that's my answer to the first one.
I actually agree with Pete. I just don't know if people are low enough on him, other than people that only watched the Ohio State game last year and his losses, maybe.
I don't know if I'm low on Arch, but I'm not in your all's camp because I want to see him elevate a team. I thought he won some games and played very well at times last year. I never got the sense that he put Texas on his back and carried the horns to victory. Will we see that this year? So for that, you could probably put me in the wait and see crowd, or if you want to call me a skeptic because of that, then completely get it. Probably.
I agree with you. I think we both agree with you there. I just think he's going to now.
He's loaded around him. You know, as a coach told me over the weekend, like, that guy's talent is so good around him, and you're seeing it in Sarkisian's comments. You know, somebody was like, why is Sark popping off so much? Because he knows his team is really good. So I found that pretty interesting. And yes, like, Arch Manning, outside of Columbus, is probably going to have the best talent around him on the offensive side of the ball of anyone in college football. I'm pretty bullish on Bear Bachmeier. I'm intrigued to see his next step. I thought he was a football player playing quarterback last year. And now I think, in talking with people at BYU and visiting with Kalani a couple of weeks ago and their offensive coordinator, Aaron Roderick, the sense is that he's more of a quarterback and that he's taken a next step. And they told me point blank. They said, look, we didn't get him until last summer, and we never changed anything in our offense in August in terms of how we were operating or installing. Like, he caught up that quickly. So we'll see. I'm big on him. The buzz out of Knoxville on Faison Brandon, the former five-star number one or number two quarterback prospect in that class, depending on your recruiting service. The people I talk to believe he's a future NFL player. So I'm again, wait and see, but players that I'm intrigued to see, those are a couple at the top of the list for me.
Where are you guys on Jennings, since it's timely, from SMU? And what about Mensah joining the talented skilled positions?
I'm really intrigued on Mensah. I don't know how good he's going to be. He could be really good. I think he's somebody I would not bet on either way. I'll tell you a player that people seem to like, but I think stinks, is John Mateer.
I'm totally with you. I do not get
John Mateer at all.
I'm with you. He had a hand injury, but I am 100% with you. In fact, I texted Priester during the game, why do people still like John Mateer?
I'm just baffled by that one. So,
yeah, and I mean, that one is fueling a lot of, you know, Oklahoma hope and hype going into this season. I would say a fascinating case study. Mensah is a good one. I like Kevin Jennings. You know, the first year he won the starting job, they were kind of going back and forth between Jennings and another guy before Lashley just finally settled on Jennings and said, no, we're riding Kevin Jennings from here on out. So I think it's a big year for him. Mensah, I've shared this story before. Like, when he left Tulane, they were very upset that he left. He just led them to a conference championship. They did not expect him to go and lead Duke to an ACC championship. They did not think they were losing a guy that would translate like that. So now, with the expectations at Miami, because he went to a Duke program that didn't have expectations. So now, with the expectations at Miami, how does he navigate that? And a little tougher schedule than what he had at Duke. The other one for me is Sam Levitt. Arizona State, by the end, didn't try real hard to keep him, but Lane Kiffin has proved very adept with quarterbacks and taking quarterbacks out of the portal. And the early buzz is very encouraging for LSU people on Levitt. But again, put him in that wait and see, prove it to me category. What about Brandon Sorsby?
What about him?
I thought we were going to get through a podcast without the Brandon Sorsby news. Yeah, can't happen.
Oh, sir. That's a perfect segue to this question from DHS Spartan 1985. It appears that all of the Irish Illustrated podcast hosts expect CJ Carr to take a significant step forward this season. Many second-year starters do, but some go through the sophomore slump. What gives you all such conviction, y'all, is apparently to make me comfortable. For the questioner, what gives us all such conviction that CJ Carr will be the sensational sophomore and not the slumping sophomore? T.O., you never get to go first. I'm going to let you go first.
I never do get to go first in these things. You know, it's like we're just effusive in our praise of what Arch Manning can become. I feel the same way about CJ Carr. I mean, you can look at CJ, you could nitpick CJ Carr's last season last year and say, all right, his worst games were against the four best teams that they played. Like, he threw pick, you know, Miami, but that was his first start. A&M, I think he played well. He just had an unfortunate pick. USC, they ran for 300 yards. he did not play his best game. The only time he threw two interceptions was Pittsburgh. That was the next best defense on a slate of bad teams that they faced. So if you're a nitpick, I just think you're nitpicking a first-year player. CJ Carr is the best pure passer at Notre Dame since Clausen, and now he has seen defenses, learned to process, learned what he didn't know. He's strong. He's a better athlete than Clausen. I cannot see CJ Carr struggling this year. Like when Gino Gadulli said, we could just get exactly what CJ Carr did last year and would be fine. He will not be what they were last. He will not be what he was last year. He's going to have a great season. The key is he maintains and has the key is he doesn't press too much. If it's 10-7 at BYU in the third quarter, instead of 17-3, or if Miami comes in and is in an absolute fantastic football game with Notre Dame, I don't think he will. I would take CJ Carr in a fantastic game against Miami over Darian Mensah in Miami.
And I know Gadulli said that. I also don't think it's true that they could just have what Carr did last year and be fine. Like, my point is, how do you replace Love and Price with CJ Carr's right arm? I mean, that's going to have to be how this offense functions. He's got all the talent in the world to do it. Mentality is an interesting, if it gets off track, I think it's going to be much more of a between the ears than my fundamentals are off or I misread a defense, because he can run a little hot and cold. And like, I think he's got that perfectionist vibe about him, and he can get in his own head a little bit, which we saw against USC. So there's a little bit of like, we'll wait and see on that. But man, the physical tools, the returning experience, really nice receiver room, the fact that the offense has to lean on him as a passer, all that would point to me as great, great season is incoming for him.
Yeah, I mean, obviously he loses a transcendent player in Jeremiah Love and an extremely elite player in Jadarian Price, but then the offensive line is more experienced overall this year, I think, and certainly the weapons in the throw game are much better than they were a year ago and much more spread out. And so I think those are all things. I know when Gino said that, I took it to mean like a similar rate of production, not the exact same numbers. I just took it to mean if CJ operates like he operated last year and builds on that, then I think that was the way I interpreted Gino's comments. But I agree with Pete that it rests a lot on his right arm. And I think he's taking that step. I think we've continued to see him taking that step. And then now, as we record this, just a few days on the heels of the Manning Passing Academy, we saw some videos of him down there. We saw some interviews. We saw some other people talking about CJ Carr down there. So he certainly did nothing to tamp down expectations with what he was able to do at the Manning Passing Academy.
And I love his attitude as a leader. And as Marcus has hinted at, and you guys have seen, he is a trash talking dude.
Yes.
Out there. Yeah. Like he's picking fights with the Notre Dame's defense. They can't hit him, so he can tamp it down a little bit when he's in a game. But I think they need it. I mean, I don't mind that from a quarterback at all.
No, I think that you have a quarterback like that, that does nothing but marshal your offensive line, particularly together, even more so. They love seeing that. That makes them be the group that hustles. The rare time that CJ Carr does get knocked down, you're going to see those offensive linemen hustling to pull him up.
Next question from Rajtown 23, one of our most important contributors. What would the most amount of transfers you could see ND taking in an offseason, particularly this coming winter, maybe, considering they want to be a high school-driven program but also need to contend every year? It's a good question for this year, Pete, because
I assume
they lose a lot.
Yeah, I don't know what the number, like, it's impossible to know what the number would be. You know, that's instead of 8, do they take 11? Maybe. You know, I guess I would question the also, I mean, I know you want to contend every single year, but next year they're not going to be as good as they are this year. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to this. Like, if they got the quarterback figured out in-house, and maybe they can press on and take a shot at it. But if they don't have the quarterback figured out in-house, then I think it gets a little bit more sticky. So it's a good question. I don't think there's a way to answer it on June 29th.
Yeah, I like the question from Rajtown 23 because it opens the door to a little bit big picture discussion. And I agree with what both of you all have just said. And I have a hard time seeing Notre Dame right now in this era of college football taking more than 10 dudes in a single portal cycle. But right now, to Rochdown's question, we don't know exactly what the college football transfer portal is even going to look like in January. There's been a proposal floated just within the last 7 to 10 days of shortening it from 15 to 10 days. Okay, that's fine. The majority of guys go in, they're committed within 10 days. That's not a huge impact. What is a potentially huge impact is the Protect College Sports Act. And there's growing hope, I would say, on Capitol Hill that they have enough votes to get it through the Senate and onto the House floor. If you bring that up, and it's pertinent here because part of the language in the Protect College Sports Act of 2026 takes it back to a one-time transfer rule and makes it a little bit more difficult, or certainly is meant to give student athletes in general a little bit more pause before he or she just leaps right into the transfer portal. So if the Protect College Sports Act passes before the transfer portal comes online for 2027, I think you could see fewer transfers entrance because of that.
Great question. I'm not going above 10 at all for next year. And that's partly because kicker and punter should be already figured out. They're coming back. Those are the automatics. But if, let's say, everybody really good, Notre Dame's great, everybody really good leaps that could leave, you're going to need a linebacker, a safety, a cornerback. You should always re-recruit wide receivers in the portal to recruit over what you have that didn't work out. I'm still on the side you might want the quarterback coming in, unless, as Pete said, unless you figured out in-house. Nickel. You could need that. I mean, you're going to have Dallas Golden and Jaden Sanders, maybe not. But look what Notre Dame did. Their number one position at the end of last year for all of us was probably corner, and they went out and got two. So I think Marcus Freeman is always looking. It's, you know, we're using cliches all the time with Freeman, but he is looking to enhance. His best, he had Zachary Golden in reserve, and he went out and got two corners. That's just, I never would have thought they were getting corners in the portal last year, and now we're talking about a starter and the Blue Gold Game star. So I at least six. If you lose everybody, you need a linebacker, a safety, a corner, a receiver, arguably a quarterback, probably a quarterback, honestly, maybe a nickel. So, and that's without even thinking ahead. What if they lose? What if Brew's so good he goes pro? And Onye's gone too, and Hughes is gone too. You might need a defensive tackle, although maybe you start rolling with your young guys. I think the young guys they've recruited defensive tackle impacts 2028 more than 2027.
And also, like, they've signed multi-year transfers last year.
Yep.
That helps too. You know, it's like, I think in the past, it's like you're just getting one-year players and you're like, okay, those guys leave, you got to get another one-year player. It's, you know, but also the flip side is like, what if Quincy Porter doesn't work out?
Yeah, but always want wide receivers though. You always want.
You know, it's, we just, I think in the past there was much more a certainty of production from their transfers because they had done it in college. Now it's, they're taking guys who have not done it, and you're just kind of hoping and projecting for the best.
Next question from Formica1023. Can you talk about when recruits sign their NIL contracts, and how does that differ by heavily recruited you are? So basically 5-star versus 3-star. Does this ever bleed into National Signing Day? And second part of this, guys, JB, you can go first. 27 player and 28 player both committed this month. Do they both sign NIL deals now?
I'll start with the second part first, and that is, it's not automatic. It also depends on the states that they're from. Is it 39 states now that have high school NIL? I wish I had the number in front of me. I apologize for not having more precisely than that. It has increased exponentially in the last few years of the states allowing high school NIL, and that makes a huge difference. Like I was told, the kid from Metro Atlanta, maybe Buford, Duluth, one of those places, had already made more than seven figures before he got to Texas A&M because he had signed an NIL deal with the Aggies, or with the Aggies club, after he committed to them in high school, and that sort of bound him in. Also, it's different. Like some schools and programs are now putting clawbacks or buyouts into their high school recruits' contracts. I know of a significant Notre Dame rival that's doing exactly that. And so that's, you start getting that money early, but then you keep getting recruited by these other places. And if you decide to look around, some of them, I think I've been told, some of them even have a penalty once you've committed. If you take a visit somewhere else, you can be fined, or they can hold your next payment or something like that. So there are a bunch of layers to it. How does it impact right now their NIL contracts? Yes. The amount you're recruited, your recruit status, all of that factors into the money that you're receiving. But I will say this ties in, visited with multiple SEC coaches at that Excel symposium on Thursday and Friday, and it ties right into the great story that Pete wrote a couple of weeks ago. And the quote is, man, Notre Dame is spending some money. They're much more active in the high school space right now than what they were. That's a direct quote from an SEC coordinator that I was with. And he was lamenting the fact that they had lost two recruits in this 27 class to Notre Dame.
Yeah, Notre Dame's a predator in the space. They're doing a great job of it. So it's, you know, when people talk about, like, why is recruiting hot? Why is Notre Dame doing so well? Like, Freeman's a big part of it. Notre Dame's a big part of it. Winning's a big part of it. NIL is a huge part of it. And they're doing a great, great job paying up.
I'm so sorry, Pete. And I would just add in there, and I get it too. Like, nobody wants to wear Under Armour shoes. That's the fact of the matter. The other Under Armour gear I like fine. But I bring that up also here only to say, right now, the way that college athletics is, you want to be Adidas or you want to be Under Armour, because they are the two programs, or the two companies, I should say, that are helping their programs the absolute most. Under Armour was very active with Joey O'Brien. Adidas is being incredibly, incredibly multiple six figures active in trying to help steer David Gabriel Georgis, the top running back, to Tennessee over Ohio State. And Tennessee point blank switched from Nike to Adidas. That's happening this week because of Adidas's aggressiveness in the NIL space. So I just bring that up. Like, I get the frustrations with Under Armour, and you want the Nike gear, and I'm a believer, especially a decade ago, that stuff made a huge difference in recruiting. Now they'll wear just about anything for the money that they're getting paid. You might get them out there in Birkenstocks for some of the for the rate that some of these deals are going.
It seems like more of an Oregon move right there.
if they lose Parks, that's why. But guys, I'm going to jump ahead because now we're on topic. Denver Maximus wants to know, in order, biggest reason the Irish are able to land a slew of elite defensive linemen that in the past they could only dream of doing over a five-year period. In order, what are these four reasons rank? Marcus Freeman, Charlie Partridge, Notre Dame itself. I guess that would be everything involving Notre Dame. And NIL.
I would go NIL. Right. Go ahead. NIL is number one for me.
Correct. I agree. What's your number two?
Number two is Marcus Freeman.
I agree. Same.
Number three is Charlie Partridge.
I would flip Partridge in Notre Dame itself, but I hear you out. I don't have a strong opinion on it.
I think Freeman and Partridge sell Notre Dame, which puts Notre Dame ahead of Charlie Partridge, which is hilarious.
I think sometimes the Notre Dame itself is position specific. So maybe maybe Notre Dame itself is number three in my quarterback reasoning.
Yeah.
Right.
Not in
right.
my defensive tackle reasoning.
For tight ends, Notre Dame itself might be two.
Offensive lineman tight ends, Notre Dame itself might be two. Actually, yeah. Sure it is. Right behind NIL, which everybody loves. All right. This is a great question. I'm sorry, JB. This is yours.
Yeah, back off. From Maltese Irish, you're not going first now. From Maltese Irish, looking back to their true freshman seasons, which, if any, of the following players do you think would have started on this year's team? Pete Sampson, I'm going to you first. Kyle Hamilton, Blake Fisher, Michael Mayer, or Ben Morrison? The floor is yours, sir.
Hamilton and Mayer are definite yeses. Fisher, I think, would have been a yes. Morrison is harder to project, because he didn't start at the beginning of his freshman year. Obviously, he came on and was great. But is, I don't know. Morrison, I don't know. Is he better than DJ McKinney or Christian Gray? By the end, yeah. I mean, I don't think either of those guys are going to be second-round picks. But you could have a discussion about Morrison, but you could not have a discussion about Hamilton or Mayer. I think Fisher would have beaten out Kirby Lambert. That right tackle.
So I think Fisher would start at right guard, making Tim Priester very happy because he liked him at guard.
Yeah, that's possible too.
Fisher would start at right guard and Lambert would start at right tackle, or they just keep Kirby Lambert at right guard and start Blake Fisher at right tackle. Kyle Hamilton would start at nickel and the world would end and he would dominate everybody, because that's what he kind of did when Jalen Elliott and Alohi Gilman were the starters and he was the rotational safety. And that would be Kyle Hamilton at nickel with Tay Johnson and Don Shuler. And Leonard Moore on one side is a massive issue for offenses. Bachmeyer would not look good to you anymore, JB, if that was the situation. Michael Mayer would start on, no matter, Michael Mayer would start, he could walk in on August 20th and earn the starting tight end job. No offense to Cooper Flanagan, but Flanagan would be the backup tight end to Michael Mayer. Morrison is so interesting. With what they recruited, I'd say no. He would eventually win the job, though, because he was so good. Like, Leonard Moore didn't start over Gray or Morrison, and Leonard Moore was better than both. Yeah. So they have really stacked it at corner. You might not get the reps if you're Morrison to make those plays. Like, he was – you're comparing him to Clarence Lewis – or comparing him to Christian Gray, DJ McKinney, Jaden Sanders, Mark Zachary, Dallas Golden, and Leonard Moore. So I'd say Morrison doesn't get to start, but they might figure out around mid-season, like, how come Notabene can get open at wide receiver where we're playing this Morrison kit when that's ones versus twos, and that might get him his chance. Before I read next question, Michael Mayer would start literally if he just showed up for the Wisconsin game and they told him to run a couple routes because he didn't have a training camp. Remember he told us? It was COVID. He didn't have a summer. They didn't have training camp. They just started preparing a little bit for the season. And Michael Mayer was that good as a true freshman. That's insane. Question number 7 from Sigles, who we know. 68 days till kickoff. Each of you fellas has 68 seconds to make a case for your offensive and defensive MVPs for the 2026 season. I'm going to give you guys all 6.8 seconds instead of 68 seconds. CJ Carr and Leonard Moore do not count.
Well, I'm not going to waste your time on offense then. So if you want to go defense, you could make an argument for Bukayo Traore because I think he's going to have a just phenomenal final year with, I know 10 sacks is like this holy grail that very, very few people achieve, but I wouldn't shock me if he was pushing that. And the plays, like I get it, Leonard Moore's picks will be great. Some of them will be 30 yards down the field. Bukayo's strip sack might be 10 yards in the backfield, so that can flip a game on its head in a hurry. But offense is Carr. Like, if you guys want to spend time on somebody else on offense, go for it.
Yeah, well, you've set the mold there, Pete. So I won't. Defensively, I'm going to go with Tay Johnson. He becomes the best eraser in college football. We know how good Notre Dame's front seven is and should be. And we know they're really good in the secondary, but Tay Johnson elevates it to where teams are terrified to throw against Notre Dame, period.
I'm going to do the old, when you're at the end of the year and you have to give people awards, like Notre Dame used to do under Brian Kelly. Remember, they'd make up awards for people. CJ Carr is the team MVP, so we need an offensive MVP that can't be CJ Carr because, you know, you just have to give out awards to people. Normally, it would be a senior under Brian Kelly, but I'm going to give it out to Aeneas Williams, who will be the straw that stirs the drink as the offensive MVP. Defensively, if not Leonard Moore, you guys took the next two guys. All right, let's pretend Kingston Viliamuasa is as far ahead as everybody indicates, even though he had knee surgery in November. I mean, I think he's the third best player on the football team when healthy, so I'll go with Kingston playing late September through the end of January would be my other choice. But Leonard Moore is going to win the Thorpe War November 7th. You heard it here first. When he moves all over the field. Final question. I love it that no coincidence Pete Sampson happens to be on this podcast. Golden Domer 25. Half of the U.S. national soccer team got stuck in traffic and won't make their next World Cup match. That is some awful traffic. Notre Dame needs to send 4 football players to fill the roster. 1 goalie, 1 defender, 1 midfielder, and 1 striker. Who is Irish Illustrated, or in this case, Pete Sampson, sending?
Well, I mean, the traffic in the Bay Area can be pretty bad for, you know, to make sure you don't get... You're late for the Bosnia-Herzegovina match on Wednesday night. But Jasper Skaife is goalie. It's pretty obvious. Like, goalies punt. Punters punt. All right. So that works together. You also, like, goalies look like Jasper Skaife sort of looks like long, tall, strong. Joey O'Brien, if we're going for a center back on defensive position, if we're going for more of like a fullback overlapping, I'm not sure who I'd pick there. Depends on what kind of system Mauricio Pochettino wants to play with Notre Dame's talent. Midfielder Jordan Faison, shifty, short. I think that was pretty obvious. Striker was difficult, but I settled on Tay Johnson just because I think his sort of closing speed maybe would mirror kind of runs in behind where it's a lot of like full burst going 100 miles an hour at a time. So, yeah, those are my 4 guys.
I was going Logan Thomas for my goalie because wingspan like a condor. I was going with Leonard Moore as my defender. At midfielder, I was going to go with Adon Schuler, and striker, I had Jasper Skaife.
Nice. I need the Faison brothers out here in some way because I just believe they can handle themselves on the pitch borrow a line from Pete Sampson. Yeah. And if I'm moving a goalie around, I mean, I'm getting Leonard Moore in the goal. I'm sorry. There's nothing gets past Leonard Moore. That's the way to go. And you could put Michael Mayer in this too. He could win a job there. We're talking about Michael Mayer winning a job. You just throw him out there. There's no way he wouldn't. So guys, that was fun for an off-season podcast. Actually, we talked a lot about Notre Dame football, and also how do the Faison brothers not both out there? They are. What about Matt Jeffrey? Could you just do a whole lacrosse?
Ooh, yeah, Matt Jeffrey would be good. Jeffrey, yeah. I mean, Jordan Faison played soccer growing up for quite a while, so he's.
You know. Well, I had Faison until you took him first, and so then okay. I was just differing for the sake of being different.
Spencer Schrader, bring him back. He was a big time soccer player.
He was big time. Yeah.
Well, we're going to do something different, and we're going to not have a podcast on Thursday, July 2nd. It is going to be our first podcast off, and Jack Freeman, I don't know when the last time our last podcast off. I'm going to guess it was somewhere around last July that we had a podcast off, but that will be the case this weekend. Hope everybody has a fun and safe holiday weekend. Keep your fingers away from the fireworks. For Pete Sampson, The Athletic, John Bryce of USA Today, I'm Tim O'Malley of Irish Illustrated. Thanks for listening and watching Irish Illustrated Insider.